Welcome to the RPG Design Panelcast, presenting the very best recorded panels and seminars about game design and publishing. These panels have been made possible thanks to the kind contributions of the panel speakers at Metatopia 2023. Episode 371, Adapting Someone Else's Sandbox, presented by Cam Banks and Amanda Valentine.
The fact that there are two of you in the audience and two of us.
Yes. Anyone listening, hello, the room is reasonably empty.
This is a thing where I would love to talk about. Now, 2023, in November, the things that we have learned and we have suffered through and have dealt with and now observing about playing out of these sandboxes,
I think it has so much pain.
But the fun part about it is it is not the same as it used to be, and there are some good things and some bad things about that.
Yep.
And what I would probably indicate as the thing is, like, at any time in RPG publishing history, there are the people who do the licensed games, and there are the people who like, don't do those. And there is a lot of crossover because publishers who do a licensed game such as Aliens will also publish their own internal IP because they've got that springboard or they have people who are interested. I don't think that when we're talking about sandboxes in the same sense as, you know, like a licensed game, we're not talking about a publisher's own, probably heavily hyped and marketed IP that it's made itself. Mutiny Zero, for example, freely is their own thing. Tales from the Loop is not their own thing. That's from Simon Stoddard, but it's also that's kind of their thing because it's their system and whatever, but it's actually a license, right? But I think smart people can tell the difference between those two. Like, this seems like a thing I've never seen Mutiny Zero anywhere. But when I was talking about this with someone else recently, they reminded me that's actually an IP that was older than
or back. It was like a video game.
Well, yes, it was, but that was licensed from there too, right?
Yep.
But Mutant is a thing that has been around in Sweden for decades. Much like Dragonbane, the new thing they put out, which is Drekar of Femina, which is one of the earliest fantasy RPGs published in Sweden. And that game was basically RuneQuest, but redone in the Swedish language. And when they did it, they're like, we don't need all Glorantha. That's stupid. Let's make up our own world, because D&D/RPGs, blah, blah, blah. So that license became a thing that has carried on through multiple publishers and now freely has it. And they're doing it because they're all fans of it when they were kids.
So the lesson here is license IP in other countries, other people won't recognize it.
Yeah. And you can't call it Drekar of Femina in English because everyone's like, that's a funny name. Did you just say dragons and demons? And you're like, yes, that's actually what it is. We're going to call it Dragonbane because we don't want to call dragons and demons. You think that's probably too much like D&D? Yeah, but sure, that's the whole point why I had the
answer.
But what this comes back to is that a lot of the publishers that I've been talking to people about this too, leading up to this panel actually, is to sort of say, can you go out there and do anything now, 2023, as a new designer or person who is making something for a company that is not a licensed IP from somewhere, or a 5e D&D setting / thing that you've made, supplements or campaigns or whatever, and have success? If you haven't had anything before, where do you get that success, right? And I think some people say, well, then how do I do that? How do I get that license stuff? And what do I look for? What are we even talking about? And there are people who will say, all of that is nonsense. Make it your own thing. It's going to be great. You'll publish it. I'm like, yes, that's what indie people do all the time, right? Are they able to bring in the kind of numbers that these other things do? And that's the real crux of what I'm talking about here, is that if we're talking about working on licenses, the reason you do that is because you somehow think that you'll get a lot more money out of it than you will if you just do serial numbers filed up game, which is whatever. Some stuff will prove me wrong, like if you do anything on a search for Kickstarter, just type in Mothership, you'll find dozens of people trying to get into that action. And even the core rules of that game are not yet out.
in terms of print. They've been floating around in beta versions of PDFs and things for a while. But loads of people are making supplements and doing Kickstarters for them and sort of the open license approach of it. For this game, which is essentially Alien, right? While there's a whole other Alien RPG out there too, which does the same thing in terms of the audience.
Now here's the question though. It's always been hard to succeed in RPGs. I mean, that's not a new change. And I would say that the risks of making your own game from the ground up are still about, are still risky. And it's still, there will be black swans. Like, you do want to, if you're making your own game, there is always the chance that you are going to be Vampire Masquerade or whatever the next breakout is. But that mouth has always been there. I think it's still about the same. But I would say licensing is more of an option for more people today. Yeah. And that's what changed the equation of the conversation.
One of the things that has made that possible is there are people, for example, Genuine Entertainment, Joe Lafavi, who we've worked with before in companies before this, Dragon Pits, for example, was a good example. He is a kind of person who has himself gone out there and found people who want to license their IP, and it connects them to the publishers or designers and people who want to make the games for them. And he styles himself as a conciliary. He's a very interesting person. And, you know, sometimes you get very frustrated with people because, like, you know, you kind of like doing it because you want to be a part of this project. It's your dream. Then he did that with Blade Runner, right? Blade Runner, he sought out and then found someone to do it and made this partnership happen. No one necessarily needs to make a Blade Runner RPG. Like, that wasn't a thing, but no one went out and said, "Oh, gee, man, Blade Runner is the RPG I want."
The market's been demanding that for years.
So, in this sense, someone like Joe kind of said, "I like the idea of this. I'm going to see what kind of IP is out there that is available." And people who would have just sort of unlocked their vault at whatever studio that exists, and someone's got a new job of licensed person at Fox or whatever, and says, "Oh, we have like 19 properties here. Let's start making comic books and video games and stuff." And then someone comes along and says, "And role playing games are a thing." And now they're even more.
Have you seen how much money Watsy makes?
Yeah, Critical Role. Look at that. That stuff makes tons of money. So that's kind of what I think is happening. You're getting a lot more of these people who are trying to be the kingmakers or partnership brokers in this, where you didn't really have that before. We were at Margaret Wise Productions. It was Margaret's agent who did all that for us. She certainly wasn't doing it as an independent, right? It was like, go out and find it, then bring it back in-house. Now it's more like, let's connect you and you and you, and then we'll do it. So all of Free League stuff has been done that way. All of Modinius stuff has been done that way, really.
I think that also speaks to a increased willingness to go after more obscure licenses.
Right.
And that the market has rewarded that.
Yeah,
because classically the idea was licenses were going to be for big properties. That's what it was. Star Wars and Star Trek. And
yeah, Marvel and DC, right? Yeah,
right, exactly. That's what a licensed game is, but I blame The Witcher, but I think that people have bought into the idea that licensing a small series of moderately successful books or, you know, someone's weird art are all viable paths.
Yeah. So that leads me to where I think we are now, which is that right now, if you can jump into that particular space and find someone who can connect you with the person who is IP, great, you know. But what I think is going to happen more often is cases like the dude who does Lancer, who is also the creator of the Kill 6 Billion Demons, which was a webcomic and then comic book. It's the whole thing. He just decided, I want to do an RPG that's going to be mechs with a super, super narrative kind of, like, you know, framing thing around a super crunchy tactical mech fighting game. That's what Lancer is, right? But that came out of him wanting to do it as a creator. He didn't go out and find it. It's an idea he's invented. I think, though, there are more of these people who are IP owners who are looking to partner with someone who is a designer. So Kieran Gillen is a good example, the Die RPG, which is really neat. He didn't do all that himself. He got someone to help him. And I'm seeing a lot of that happen now too, right? So and someone's got an IP idea, and they're now wanting to do something with it, but they don't themselves necessarily have all the experience or the handshaking and things that need to get an actual product made, and that's when they partner with someone.
There's a case to be made that we're downstream from a change in content creation that started more than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
As the independent creators started branching off and taking ownership of things, and now we're reaping benefits.
I feel that's probably very accurate. Like, a lot of the people who I've sort of seen grumbling about the way things are working now are like, why is that particular designer doing that game? Well, how come they're using that system when it could be so much better than X? And it's because someone knew somebody and they just thought this was cool and they thought they'll get it, and then it happened the way it did, right?
Or is D20, just because D20 is still a default right in enough places.
But like, I think Candela Obscura, for example, is a fantastic example of a situation where someone has said, we want a, this is Critical Role and Derek DePress, and they said, we want to make a our own game now because we have been doing D&D for all this time and now we want to have our own stuff because we have a huge audience. But we also don't want to be tied to Wizards necessarily, so let's do our thing. I mean, we've got both Candela Obscura and Daggerheart, which is their more traditional one, but Candela is very story gaming. But they went out and found people to do these games for them, and some of them will contribute to the writing of it, much like Kieran Dillon did with his game, and others are like, we'll just hire a Dubai person, these people, to help us do it. And I find that to be similar to what you're talking about, this whole idea, like, you know, it's the downstream, but who the creator finds and how they end up tapping into and getting them on board seems to be a mystery to the traditional designer group of whom I probably belong to, right? Because we're all the same, all geniuses, except. But it's a thing where you're like, okay, so how do I get into that? And now I think what's happening is everyone's putting their hand up and saying, hey, over here, I make games, which is a weird kind of twist, right? It's like we're all standing on a street watching as creators drive by, and we're going, me, look, get me, I'm doing it. And then someone says, oh, you're looking interesting, come in here, I'm doing RPGs now. And so you bring him on, and everyone's like, why did they pick him? Why is she in the car with this guy? It's because they were somehow to draw the attention, or the creator liked what they did in some way or something about it. So now we're getting into the whole, there's PR, and there's marketing, and there's social media, and there's influencer, and there's all of this stuff which we didn't even have, you know, 15, 20 years ago, right? So.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm Amanda Valentine.
I'm Diego.
Hi, Diego. Nice to meet you. I think we should ask, this is Cam Bank.
Yeah, hi, okay.
I think we should ask Diego what he wants to hear, because the four of us can come anywhere, anytime.
Yeah, we all know. So Diego, this is, we've been talking about licensing and how it's changed and how it works and how it can be done. What's your interest in this subject?
I think I'm just curious, mostly just because, yeah, like you kind of like you said, like I got into role playing a couple years ago, like kind of like right before COVID started.
Good time.
But yeah, right. Yeah, it's worked out really well for me. You know, I mean, even since then, I've noticed it's just like every third Kickstarter for a role playing game is like, we're making this a role playing game now.
Right.
Like, you know, and I was just interested in like kind of thoughts on like why that might be, or
because it makes a ton more money.
Yeah, well, right,
I mean, right off the bat.
However,
but
there is a corollary to that, because you have to pay someone money to do that,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Right, and that's why someone like Dennis Dittmuller will tell you, don't use anyone else's stuff, make your own IP, be the master of your own domain. You know, I'm like, that's cool if I already have a presence up there that I can do it,
right?
If I'm starting out and I want to go out there and say, I'm making a game, it's all about weird flower-powered mech lords of the 23rd century, that you say, well, that's cool, I don't know who you are and I don't know what this is.
Right.
tell me why this is important. But if you say, I'm going to take Neon Genesis Evangelion and make it an RPG because someone slipped me the license for that over drinks at a bar some night, suddenly you have a whole lot of people interested.
Right.
But now you have to pay that person for having used it.
Right.
And probably residuals and probably continue to there, and then there's the whole.
Right.
The money becomes a lot bigger, but also the payout becomes. And I think when I was talking a little bit about Kieran Gillen and other sort of IP creators who are now bringing people in to do the games for them, that's what's different. Because a lot of time what they're doing is like, I want a game about my IP, right? I'm the person who wants it, not you. I'm not just sort of like the possessor of the IP and therefore you should pay me money to use it. I'm going to have an agreement where I do some stuff and then you make the stuff and then we all have some kind of like agreement where the money, revenue gets split these ways and stuff. It's a whole different conversation than it used to be. Right? So I think that's one thing I'm seeing people do now, and I think that's what's happening, is you're getting that whole, it's a two-way street. Were really cool. DC was not looking for someone to do an RPG for anything, right? It didn't care. And last time we went to them, I think they were talking about doing something in-house anyway, and they haven't, so whatever. The Marvel game was in-house, but that's a whole complicated story. But that whole thing there is interesting because someone at Marvel said, look at all the RPG money. And for why not? Let's do it. You know?
Realize there are a couple of euros missing from the numbers that you're used to.
But they still hired someone who they knew and trusted to shepherd that particular project to go through because they've done that for years. And I think a lot of this is where you get that whole people who know each other stuff that I was saying before, right? So for someone like you, if you decided, like, I'm Diego, I want to make this game, and I like this TV show that's come out,
right,
or this book series, like Fourth Wing, right? They want to put Fourth Wing as a young adult novel about dragons and some woman who's fighting them and so on, and it's super popular. You would have to find out who owns the rights to that. Is it the person who wrote the book? What's her face? Yaros, I forget her name now. Is it her publisher? Does she have the ability to give you the rights for that? Well, maybe she does. Maybe her agreement with the publisher is not that way, right? When you get situations like in the past we've had, who is the person who actually has the rights to this? And do they have all of them? So for many, many years, Highlander was completely impossible to do anything with because there was actual disagreement between people who thought they had rights to it and people who said they weren't, went to court about it. So there's a Highlander collectible card game, which was scrapped twice, I think, because someone said, I have the rights to that. Cool, here's some money. Can I have the rights that I can make a game? Yes. Okay, I'm making the game. We're going to press. Oh, I was just sued. I don't have the rights to that. You're like, cool. My lawyer is fired. Goodbye, lawyer. You know. But that's a thing, right? And so when you find out who that person is and you can get it from them, that's when you have to have that conversation, like, what is this going to be like?
Right.
And I think part of it, maybe, and I don't know, I don't want to talk too much about it, but I feel that part of the whole situation is, do you want to get into bed with these specific people? How long do you imagine your actual game is going to last for? Do you have the rights that go on for a long time? Is this a one-and-done thing? What's the deal, right? And if you want to use crowdfunding for it, you're way more likely to get the money and the capital and stuff you need for it than if you just try and go off your own back and just go through it. Unless you're like a venture capitalist, which case, you know, you can create your own company and hire a whole bunch of old
people. But you're better to do it most of the time. Plus,
you'd think.
Oh, yeah. Unless you're the Saudis, and then we go to all of them.
Yeah, and Amanda's worked with me on a lot of RPG licenses in the past. I'm curious, Amanda, if you've had your own perspective on some of the ones that you don't have to give away, obviously, in certain details, but...
The restrictions that come with an IP are incredible and weird. And you usually don't know them until you are already well into whatever you're doing, and they're likely to change when there's staff turnover, which happens all the dang time. Also, you end up with an audience that you have to please, who's never going to buy your game because they're the ones who asked you to make it. But when you're in the process of pleasing them, you aren't necessarily making what you think will be the best game. It's a weird and complex thing.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'm going with that.
Plus, it needs to be a living IP.
That's the other side of it, right? If we were to do Supernatural now...
Oh, God, I was flashing back to the number of things I pulled out of my ass for the Hunter's book that were just wrong.
Yeah.
As the war hall.
Yeah.
If we were to do Supernatural now, that show was very different from when we did it at Good Night Otherwise, because we were in season 3, I think.
Yeah.
We had just got Castiel as an angel in the show. And he was this mysterious, interesting character when I see him. And there was angels, and there was archangels.
There was a mysterious trickster who we just thought was a trickster god.
There's lots of stuff going on. All turns out to be different and nonsense now, because they just went through and had the world ending about 4 times. Hell wasn't real and stuff. Yeah.
And if your book's delayed, it can be outdated before it even goes out.
So that's another thing. Like, if can you put a book out that's basically a license for something that's no longer a thing that is out there? And then you're like, well, is there an audience for that? Right? The part that I think most people get shocked by is when they start working with someone and go, I really like the idea of Tron. Maybe we should do a Tron game. Who owns the rights to Tron? Oh, well, Disney does. That's hard. But let's say it wasn't Disney. Let's say it's someone else. Then you go to them and go, hey, I'm thinking of this cool show a movie I loved when I was a kid in the 80s called Tron. It was great. And lots of us loved Tron. It was cool. I'd like to do a game about it. And that's when the person says, funny you should say, but we've actually got a new movie coming out next year and we haven't announced it yet. And you're like, what? And that can happen literally as you're making product. For example, Star Wars is the best example, I think, that you can give of something that came out after something was just done. There wasn't anything happening with Star Wars when the V6 version came out for West End Games. There were 3 movies, and Splinter of the Mind's Eye in the Han Solo books. There were no expanded universe novels. Ed, the Empire had nothing.
Yeah.
Oh, Ewok movies. You know, but it was like that.
No, that never happened.
Star Wars was a trilogy and some stuff.
And a couple other things, correct.
And so they got the whole thing, they made a game, and it was amazing. And the funniest thing happened was Lucasfilm kind of woke up from a slumber and said, hey, people are making stuff for this universe. And then someone else said, I'd like to write a book. Well, we'll do novels now. And that's cool. By the way, everything these game guys are doing is open for you to use because we own it. So if you like the name of these Hammerhead people, which are the Ithorians, which we didn't name, but they did, and we just took it because it's ours anyway, you can use that. If you like the name of these planets, which we had to come up with because they asked us what the name of the planet was and we had to tell them, we went to George and he gave me like 6 pages worth of weird goofy names that we used. All the stuff which was done for the Star Wars V6 system game became canon for Star Wars. And then the property just took off while they were still publishing the game. Initially it was dead, right? For all intents and purposes, it was nostalgia. Then it was part of a living ecosystem. And now, several Star Wars RPGs later, different companies and everything else, they even went and did the whole, like, let's just turn all that into legends.
Right.
It's not canon. It clapped.
Have you had to deal with toxic fandom for IPs that you've worked on? And is there a standard operating procedure for not generating death threats?
It's don't do anything anyone likes.
I don't think we actually ever really have had anything that has had the most toxic people even come. of the air company.
There was some weirdness with Dragonlance occasionally, but it wasn't.
Right.
In fairness, I mean, like, the most toxic folks have been frequently in the gaming community.
I don't know if that's true, but Star Wars fandom is absolutely horrible.
True. Star Wars is kind of a special case.
Trek fandom is great. It's like, unreasonably good. And people should be very happy to work on Ethan Trek because the fans love it. Until you do Discovery and have people go, oh, it's just a crime all the time. And you're like, okay, well. Hi, welcome to Star Trek. This is the toxic fandom community.
I remember mentioning to Amanda at one point, who I am married to, for hey, why don't you, when you were with fandom, pursue a Ultron license? We like Ultron. And you said, sweet Jesus, no. Or something to that effect. Because the fandom was just so hostile to goodness.
Yeah.
That
probably the closest that we came to was probably with Motus, right? Because if we had gone any further with Master of the Universe, we would have had to deal with, like, segment of the fan base, which is an aging toy collector group who may or may not, like, despise everything you've ever done that looks even a little bit like She-Ra. Right?
I mean, at that point, you're jumping onto existing, you just happen to get roped into existing wars.
Yeah.
Which is not uncommon, then, I grew up.
Yeah. But I don't think that we've never created a toxic situation. We've maybe inherited something, but I don't think.
Well, that was my guess. Yeah. That's where I was.
Yeah.
With Dragon Prince, the people above us looked into the. Who was problematic?
Some of the creators, or one of the creators.
Yeah, and they looked into it and came up with what our party line was and why this was okay.
And honestly, there was a lot of the stuff that it was so mild in comparison to some of the stuff we could have to deal with at this point. That, like imagine working on an MCU thing and having to have something that has any connection
to John Major. You decided to rename Universe 616.
Yeah. Like a lot of that stuff is awful, and you have to go into that thing and just sort of like have your eyes covered up. Just that I'm doing the thing, I'm doing the thing. And I think truly, we wouldn't have had much impact on us anyway if we did anything to do with those things, any kind of. Because the people you actually end up reaching is just a small part of them who want to play games.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is it? Hello. I'm Cam, this is Amanda.
Sorry, I'm hearing you, right?
One of the things that I was thinking about earlier when you were San Diego about the whole, you know, getting on board, it's like you also have to understand that sometimes the people who you want to make a game for don't want to play anything. And so you kind of want to do a bit of research and say, is there actually a market for stuff I want to do, or is it just me that wants this, right?
Well, Kickstarter is real good for finding out.
Yeah.
But if you're doing an IP, you've committed a lot before
depending on the terms, yeah.
Do you have specific questions?
I'm not specifically. I was interested in kind of adaptation and how you take the market to like kind of into mechanics or but that, but also very much on like, are they approaching you? How does one even start that process?
Cool. Yeah. So actually, that's something we haven't even talked about is the actual how you change the thing from an IP into a game. Which is probably more interesting than all this nonsense about the legal agreements. As a summary of that, of the second part of that question is, we're finding that a lot of people are now being approached by IP owners to make a game. If they've somehow stuck their head above the crowd and said, hi, I make games, and someone sort of said, this person makes games, you want to have a game made of your stuff, let's make this happen, right? That's been happening. That's not great because you can't depend on that. But if you know a person who knows a person, that ends up being a lot more of what happens too, which is kind of a That said, if you have a friend who makes something that is cool and you want to license their stuff, I'm sure you have a better deal than going up to like Warner Brothers and saying, I'd like to do a game based on this property that is making $1 billion.
The thing is, just figuring out who to talk to. Because they'll shuffle you around to a million people, and then the position will have been filled by somebody else by the time you get back to wherever it is that they first said you should go to.
And I'm like involved with my team design as an employee, but I've like run convention games for them before, so them actually being exposed to when the avatar game has been a huge thing in that community.
Mm-hmm.
But they of course were already famous with stuff like Mass and Open Shadows.
Yeah. And they had a great agent who got their license for them.
Mm-hmm.
But she got licenses for me before. So I think the other thing about this that is really interesting is the whole process of adapting and what we're actually doing with license games and how we make good ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good thing to sort of pivot this to, because it's maybe a more interesting. If you have a license or you know someone who can get it, that's the whole thing. But once you get that particular thing, then now you can talk about how you do it. Maybe there's also some interest in appreciating what we had to go through to do it. So you could sort of say, well, why did that one game come out the way that it did? And the answer is, we had many stakeholders involved that told us how to do it. Right? But before I do that, though, without naming any particular companies, there was a particular IP that people went after. And it turned out that at one time, three different people, executives, directors, somebody else within that big corporation, had talked to three different publishers about getting a license for it. And when one of them actually got it, the other two were like, what? What the, we're having a deal? And I said, oh, we just found out that these people have it. And that happened. So at one point, a game I worked on would have had two other potential people making a thing just like it. But they didn't.
There was no reason to court deities.
Yeah. So, anyway, adapting things. Amanda, what's the thing that has been the most successful of our stuff that has given us the reason why we make the thing?
Successful, I will measure. Actually, instead of answering your question,
you're going to say something entirely different.
Yeah, pretty much. I think one of the things that's most important when you're adapting an IP is to figure out what people love about it and where new stories fit into it. Because there are a lot of really great things that are about, like, you know, the chosen one. So many things. There's like one amazing person, and yes, it's great and it's so much fun, but where are you playing in that world? Where do your stories fit in? And if you can't figure that out, it's not, no matter how popular it is, it's probably not great for an RPG. The other thing is that if part of what's so cool about it are these dangerously fantastic characters, like this is a not supernatural, but like supernatural games in general, like if you don't want people to be the cool, powerful vampires, you can't make all the cool characters be cool, powerful vampires, because that's all anybody's going to want to play. So you have to think about how to reward the things that the IP is really about. So if it's about overcoming temptation, then you have to make that worth doing and interesting to do, instead of like, isn't temptation cool? Yeah, I'm going to go do that. So you do have to get like, do literary analysis to a certain degree to really figure out what this is about and figure out how to make your mechanics do that. It's one reason why I do like Cortex a lot. I'm only a little biased. But like, for instance, so two of our old superhero IPs, there was Smallville. I have to admit, I'm not a huge fan of the show, but I love the game that we made from it. And then there's like Marvel Hero. So you've got one that is all about superhero action. And so that's where the focus was. For Smallville, the focus is all on like relationships and angst and, you know, what things are important to you.
Tell me your secret. Oh, okay. Tell me your secret now. Oh, okay. That's what it is.
How about that?
Nope. Still not doing anything.
And so those are the conflicts. You know, I mean, sure, people get punched every once in a while,
But even that is more about like saving face instead of like, oh no, now my nose is broken. Yeah, and so they are very, very different stories, even if they're both about superheroes. And so trying to figure out what really drives it and how to make the mechanics do that in a way that's interesting and meaningful. And then everybody gets mad at you because you didn't say how much Superman could lift.
Yeah.
So here's the cynical question. Mm-hmm. How demanding is the audience for a licensed game?
Well,
they're the audience. Well, that's the question. We're getting an audience by virtue of the license.
Yeah. That's the scene environment.
Isn't there kind of an argument for, honestly, for mediocrity in licensed products? Is the payoff of making the licensed product awesome and generally reflective of the underlying material as opposed to just the right collection of pictures and stat blocks?
So you brought up a good point. So if you were to get a license and the license was for, I don't know, Discovery of Witches, right? The TV show, which is also based on some books, which my wife has been watching lots of. Oh, that's a good example of a special character who's super special. Everyone else is just either a witch, a vampire, a demon, or something. But you are the special everything to the new person. That's bad. Gotta do that. You could say, I'm going to do a D&D 5e compatible game based on Discovery of Witches because everyone's playing D&D right now. I'm sure to get people to play this game if they do that. So I will get the 5e people who will just show up and buy my book. This is what you're thinking at the time. You may be wrong. You probably are wrong. Or I'll get the people who like the show, they're going to come and play it. And the good news is, it's easy to learn this game because everyone else plays it, and you can watch lots of actual plays about D&D. So we're doing a 5e Discovery Witches game, right? I don't have to try very hard because I just need to get lots of photo art from the shows and get someone, I'll pay someone to write up backgrounds and lore things, and someone can do the stuff about witches, and someone can do this about vampires. Cool. Great, all right, publish that book. And then at that point, the next thing you care about is, did I make money from selling all these books? Probably, maybe. Do you then care that anyone liked your game, right? And this is the point where I start to be different from some people who publish games. Because I actually do care if people like it and keep playing it after they buy it, right? There are loads of RPG books which end up on shelves places and people buy them, maybe in a PDF, or maybe they get them as a hardback and they just put them on the shelf and go, well, that's that licensed game. What's next? You know? And the person who's
an awesome artwork.
The person who pumps it goes, cool, I got your money. Next. You know, that's kind of a very cynical thing, and that's what we're talking about. I kinda like to do a good job.
You monster.
So I'm all putting away. But it does lead me into those places where you stay as authentic as you can to what they think that people should want to have if they play it. Like, do you want races and classes and Discover Witches? You probably could. You could have like vampires and witches and races, and the classes are, you know, sad person, angry person.
You've just redone D20 Modern as D20,
right.
You know.
Well, that's what Hero of Heroes is, right? That's why they do that. You could do that, and I think that the problem would then be people going, well, that's great, but I want to play my Tiefling Sorcerer as well. Can I do that?
Yes. It's a feature! It's cross-compatibility!
Your dwarf warlock.
Be a daemon in Discovery of Witches. That's basically a tiefling.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, like, one thing that's cool about Smallville, obviously the game's not still out. It's one of the things about an IP. Somebody else decides when your book comes off the shelf, and when it does, it disappears. And I don't know how many people were using it to play Smallville anyway, but those mechanics still exist. And they have appeared in a bunch of different places and are still used widely, and not just in Cortex. Like, that was a bit of a game changer. That game. And that's exciting. Doesn't bring us any money. But but still, to know that something that you did has inspired other people, there is something to that. And one reason that sometimes it feels worth not just doing a completely mediocre game.
Right.
Funny thing, actually, since Rob and Clark are in the room, people have been running an actual play show of Leverage. The RPG, which we did. A friend of mine, Brianna DaCosta, who is also on Tabletop News now, and she's a really great voice actor and cosplayer and so on. She's been on the cast for this, and there's been a guy running it, and he's been doing it by the book. It's Leverage, it's not Quartet Prime, it's just the old Leverage book. He's got all the book supplements in there. From watching that, I'm like, man, that was cool. That was a good game.
You wouldn't be thinking about that.
And I'm like, that's fun. You can't buy the game, though. What is the point of this show? And they're like, we like it. And so we want to do a stream of it. So we just run games of it online and we record it. It's on YouTube and it's on Twitch. And I'm like, the thing is, usually that's done to try and drive sales towards a product, right? What's actually happened now is that these people are bringing out old games that are no longer in print, or they're dead, or they've got even an older edition of a game. That's often what's happening. This is the show I want to run for my audience of Twitch subscribers, and maybe I've got 1,000 people who are subscribed, maybe I've got 10. But I've got my friends, I know a person over here who does acting, this person's an improv comedian, and we're going to get our group together, and you'll see our faces and boxes, and we're playing this game. And that's what happened with Leverage. And, like, the guy's like, so do you think we'll ever bring it back? I'm like, I don't like it to bring it back. I don't own any of that rights or anything. But it's one of the things you can then later point to and say, people still like this. Mm-hmm. So you did a good job when you did it. And that should be something you should look proud of.
But it still won't make you any money.
That won't make you any money. I mean, it may be a thing you point to say, hey, could the people who come in and rights to Leverage hire me again and I'll re-release it? You know, that's the kind of thing you can maybe do, but that's not... Again, not a plan that you put to you.
Probably almost as hard as getting the rights to it.
Yeah. Well, actually,
no, this is probably easier because Devlin probably pretty much owns them because I think it's all they make.
Yeah. At that point, you just send them the actual play and say, hey, is there a thing? But
I think Dean Devlin knows who I am. I could just say, hey, Electric Entertainment. Or I think even the person who wrote Electric. Their main person, I forget her name now, gosh, it's terrible, who I talked to all the time, she still works with them. So they haven't changed as a group much. But John Rogers doesn't do anything for them. It's fine. I think that the problem, though, is that like we make a good game and it's the IP is going to go away at some point. It's an issue. So that's the downside of it, I would say. But yeah, I don't want to make a mediocre game. I think that a lot of people who go into this probably don't want to either. But there's often a point where you reach in the planning of this license that you think the only way we can make any buck on this is if we do appeal to a larger base. And in the tabletop space, the larger base is 5e. And you can't even say, let's just do Fate or something now, because the current deck's also not big enough to drive in. It has to be something else. It's weird how the market shifts from new hotness to new hotness every 5 minutes, and we're all chasing after the guy. Oh, I'm glad you liked it, because we want to do a thing about that. And like, if we did like it, we don't care. But now we don't want to see it.
All right, we have a few more minutes. Is there any questions?
Yes.
Things you'd like us to cover? About.
I probably didn't talk enough about adapting stuff. What's a specific thing about adapting something to RPG that you'll be interested in?
Just how you come up with mechanics to support stories. So you talked about this a bit with the kind of core emotion of Smallville versus the other, the Marvel one that was more actual fighting. But I don't know. I feel like my experience with the Avatar Legends, it's very much about is this too broad or too narrowly focused for the characters, or with something like Avatar Legends, which had such a big span of history and profit, was advertising for the Kyoshi books too. How do you make it manageable for the entire world and bring that world into it?
It's interesting because a good case study might be the recent Star Wars game that Fantasy Flight did, where they released three separate games. And the games are functionally identical in terms of the rules, but they have enough that's different. Most of what's different is on a character level. And I think that's where we probably would find the most of that. The first thing I do when I'm designing a game is I make a character sheet. What do I want to see on the character sheet? What do I want the character stats to be? What do I want, which traits are going to be on there? And that is because two things. One, and this is the thing that Rob and I have always sort of held up. The character sheet is the wish list for the GM. This is like, hey GM, I want to play these sorts of games. So here's my thing. If I don't play this kind of character in the game, or the things that my character is good at or can do, don't show in the game. Your game is bad, and I don't like it. So I start with a character sheet, and I think that's where you start thinking, you know, what is this game about? Because the character sheet is the primary way that a player interacts with your game. So it's the most important part of the game, even more important than the mechanics, is the character sheet, right? At the end of the day, you could have a character sheet that's just a 5e rule system. If the character sheet doesn't work, you can't even access the rules very well, and you just get lost. Where all this, I don't have the skills that I do. We even have grapple in this game? What's going on? But if the character sheet is very, very cool and the mechanics are crap, you will find that out afterwards. But hopefully you don't have the crap mechanics and you know, you're worth of that. So my first thing I would do is that, and I think it's with the Edge of the Empire and Age of Rebellion and Force of Destiny, I think it was a third book. That's cool. They were very different, and you could take some of the stuff from them and mix and match. But there was a whole thing about, like, for Edge of the Empire, which was the Bounty Hunter and Smugglers game, you had an obligation. Every player character had an obligation that they had to come up with. In the Edge of the Empire, which is Rebellion kind of stuff, with pilots and things, every character had to have a duty, and there was something else for the Jedi Warrior. But yeah, you kind of have to sort of approach it maybe sometimes from that point of view. I can't encompass the entirety of my IP in one book because there's so much difference between instances. I don't blame them doing the Korra thing afterwards because I don't think Korra and the original Avatar show have very many of the same themes even in some cases, right? I prefer the Legend of Korra over the first one, which some people think I'm the same for, but I like that era a lot more, and I think the characters are more interesting in that one, which is, you know, I'm a bad guy for saying so. But I think that that's an example of where, like, that whole universe, maybe it's two different games, right? You could make a case for it being different games entirely, and having different needs that have to be met by the characters that you make and the system that you use.
I think Avatar Legends did like a good job by like saying these are five different eras and then highlighting why, like, the mechanics are the same, right? Like, airbending is still airbending, whether you're in the Kyoshi era or the Korra era, but like what you're exploring is so fundamentally different. Like you said, it could have been different books. Like,
yeah.
If I wanted to make, you know, four additional books that were each just different eras, they could have just done that. You know, I appreciate it for, as a consumer, but I probably would have bought all five.
It's just so interesting to like look at the character sheets and be like, okay, I can only do mechanics in Core Era, and I can't do an Airbender in Aang or 100 Years War Era.
Right. Yeah, if you're kind of down by whatever, like, fiction.
Yeah, which makes sense and makes the errors feel distinct and unique. It's just interesting that you put that all in one system.
We had a similar situation with Smallville where we had to have a game where you could play someone who was from Krypton and could punch a hole through a rock wall without any trouble. It's just something that they could do. And also be Jimmy Olsen.
Right.
And have that somehow be fun to play the other character who is not Clark or, you know, superpowered anybody.
And they both have to have influence on what's going on. Like, you don't want to play, you know, the character who has no impact on the world. So how do you make those kinds of characters have an impact?
And props where it's due. One of the great influences on solving problems like that for the license game to nod back to Buffy.
Yeah. That did it by giving the Whiteheads, who are the supporting characters in the show, like Xander, a bunch more points that they can do things with to spend on roles and whatever to help out and be very useful. But Buffy, the character, and Angel and other major characters who are not Whiteheads, those characters were actually more powerful rules-wise, right? So it succeeded on one level, but also there are people who still felt like, you know, why would I ever play a Whitehead if I could play a slave? And so we did approach it from a different angle. We sort of said, none of that stuff actually matters nearly as much as what you believe and who you care about, and we'll make that the central part of your character. And then everything else can kind of be like cool extra stuff you can draw on. Can I punch through wrong walls? Great. Can I solve the problem with my father and my mother having an argument about things and I feel really bad about it? Well, I can't punch my way out of that. So I guess that's going to be the main focus of today's story. And this is the Superman problem in all comics. This has always been true. How do you make Superman fun? Because he's like God and then everyone else is not. So, yeah.
Spoiler, totally solvable.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all did it. It's cold cover.
We should probably wrap up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.